Good afternoon. I'll call this remote meeting of the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee to order and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Representative Daphne.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Representative Lucero.
Happy to be here.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice. And I'll call again Representative Haley and Representative Tice again.
Present.
Thank you.
A quorum is present. The first item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes from the January 20th, 2021 meeting. Representative Cotiza Watoon, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes from the last meeting.
Representative Cotiza Watoon removes approval of the January 20th, 2021 minutes. Any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. And the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Today in this committee, we will be doing an informational overview of the gaming industry in Minnesota. We have a number of speakers, including, I believe for the very first time, a leader of a sovereign nation in the committee. Very excited about that. Before we get to that agenda, I know that Representative Daphne has some remarks that he'd like to make. So Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. Members, I think particularly given the guests today, but also on any day, it's important that we as Minnesotans and as leaders in our communities acknowledge that we are meeting on the traditional land of the Dakota and Ojibwe peoples. We make this acknowledgement to honor the Dakota and Ojibwe people who have stewarded this land throughout the generations, to honor their elders, ancestors, and descendants, as well as the land itself. We recognize the acts of genocide committed against the Native people, and we acknowledge that Indigenous people are still here and present all around us, and their voices should be uplifted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Daphne. As a reminder to members, we will, the sort of standard practice in this committee is that we take all of the testimony from our testifiers, and then we will do questions after everyone's had a chance to speak. But you are welcome and indeed encouraged to, you know, raise your hand whenever the spirit moves you, and I will recognize you after we get through our prepared testimony. With that, I am very pleased and very honored to recognize the president of the Prairie Island Community, Shelby Buck, and welcome President Buck to our committee. President Buck.
Wichoko Washte, Yishkia Wachiankapie, Dakota Ia Pate Wichota Amakiapie, Washichu Ia Shelly Buck Amakiapie. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Shelly Buck, Tribal Council President of the Prairie Island Indian Community. I want to thank you, Padamiaye, for that land acknowledgement, recognizing that where we sit today is the homeland of our ancestors, the Madawakatuan, Dakota Oyate, or Spirit Lake dwellers, those born of the waters. We are grateful for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. We do not recall a chance like this before to share our story and the impact that gaming has had on our people. There's a reason gaming is called the New Buffalo. It has provided tribal governments like ours at Prairie Island with the means to survive and thrive. Just as the Buffalo people, the Tatanka Oyate, did many generations before. We have always had the sovereign right to govern ourselves, provide for ourselves, and regulate trade and commerce long before European contact. Gaming has been and continues to be an inherent right. The 1988 Indian Gaming Regulatory Act set up a federal regulatory structure, and the industry and the landscape has evolved greatly since then. But what I want to make clear is that gaming has never been a right that was given to us by any government. In the 1800s, Native Americans were banished from their ancestral lands, forced onto isolated reservations, and faced systematic efforts to annihilate their cultures. Reservations were the last place in this country that you'd think of as an economic engine, let alone an entertainment destination. Time and the strong will of Native leaders certainly changed that dynamic. If we fast forward to today, gaming is working. Before gaming, tribal governments had to look to others, principally the federal government, for the funds they required to care for our struggling communities. The remoteness of most reservations meant that the more traditional means of economic development just wouldn't work. Gaming works for tribes as they improve the lives of their members and the conditions on their reservations. And it works for the host states who enjoy job growth and a stronger economy and reduced reliance on social services, because paychecks have replaced welfare checks. I'd like to share our Prairie Island story and the impact gaming has in Minnesota. We started with a tiny bingo hall in 1984 and now run one of the largest casinos in the state of Minnesota and have the second largest hotel property in the state. Treasure Island Resort and Casino is a destination attraction for much more than gaming. People come to swim in the water park, play golf at our 18-hole course, go boating on the Mississippi River, attend a summer concert at our outdoor amphitheater, or enjoy our other entertainment options. Obviously, that was all before the midst of the pandemic. Success does not come easy, though. We face difficult obstacles every day, and it hasn't come without some downsides that we as elected leaders must navigate. But that's the price we willingly pay for the prize of self-sufficiency. Revenue from our gaming operation funds the majority of the operating budget of our government. Let me repeat that. Gaming proceeds provide the dollars we need to operate our government and provide services to our community members. We are today the largest employer in our region and have employed more than 13,000 people since we opened our doors. The more than 1,700 jobs we provided just prior to the pandemic wouldn't exist without Treasure Island. Nearly 300 of those individuals have been with us for more than 15 years, and we're so proud of that. Our tribal members and employees all receive comprehensive health insurance from the tribe. The business funds health care and provide for the employees and community members. In fact, even when we closed during the pandemic, we ensured all employees maintained their health care benefits and insurance. We're also proud and humbled that we've been able to donate millions of dollars to charitable organizations over the years. That's a lasting impact we've created. The tribe runs the Prairie Island Police Department with 10 sworn officers, and we operate our own wastewater treatment plant. Prairie Island funds education assistance for tribal members in partnership with the Red Wing School District, and we pay 100% of college tuition for tribal members as long as they maintain a C average or better. The education benefits we offer community members wouldn't be there if we didn't have gaming. We have had to purchase back our own ancestral land, a step we believe is necessary for our future generations. We continue to grow programs that ensure our cultural practices and language remain alive for generations. Minnesota was the first state in the nation to sign compacts with the tribes to operate casinos. There are 11 federally recognized tribes in Minnesota, and collectively, they operate 19 casinos. A 2016 economic impact study conducted by Klaus Robinson for the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association captured the impressive effect tribal gaming has had on Minnesota. Consider these direct impacts. Collectively, Minnesota tribes would be the state's 14th largest employer, providing more than 15,000 jobs. The annual payroll for those jobs is in excess of $500 million, and the payroll-related taxes surpass the $126 million mark. Tribes spend more than $717 million annually on goods and services. More than half of that spend is here in Minnesota. That's like realizing the financial benefits of hosting the Super Bowl every year. And finally, consider that over the past 30 years, investment by Minnesota tribes in gaming operations and other tribally owned ventures is in excess of $2.5 billion. I think almost any state in the nation would welcome that economic impact. Despite the vast improvements that gaming has made possible for our community, there are nonetheless incredibly challenging issues that we confront daily. Unlike commercial gaming operations, Prairie Island doesn't have the luxury of being singularly focused on building our business or even growing our economy in new ways. Instead, we must dedicate some of our much needed revenue to constantly fight for our future. We are in a very unique position at Prairie Island and face serious health and safety threats that we must protect our community against. First, we are a land poor tribe and can't meet the needs of all the tribal members who would like to live as part of that community. Our land shortage was made worse when a portion of our original reservation was flooded by the federal government as a result of the Lock and Dam 3 located on the Mississippi River. Without consultation with the tribe or our consent, a nuclear power plant was then built next to our reservation. Today, a nuclear power plant and nuclear waste storage site with close to 50 casks of spent nuclear fuel now sit approximately 700 yards from our homes. There are no other human beings that must live that close to a nuclear power plant and stored nuclear waste. These challenging circumstances require precious resources that could otherwise be used to positively impact our tribe and our region. As our ancestors did before us, we survive and we thrive despite these challenges, and we continue to move forward, building a stronger future for the next seven generations. Gaming has helped us to do that. I want to thank you, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to share our story. Padami Ayepi.
Thank you, President Buck. We are very honored to have you here and really appreciate your remarks, and we'll welcome you back to this committee at any time. Our next testifier is Mr. Andy Kozak from the Minnesota Indian Gaming Community. Mr. Kozak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I also want to thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to explain a little bit of the history of what's happened in the 30 years since modern Minnesota tribal gaming began. I won't be able to match President Buck's eloquence, certainly not, but I'll try to describe some of the things that have happened since then and where we are now. I represent MIGA, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association, and I have done so. It's been my privilege to do that for the last 30 years. MIGA's members are the 11 federally recognized Minnesota Indian tribes who operate 19 casinos, as President Buck mentioned earlier. Modern tribal gaming, as we know it today, started sometime in the 80s when tribes began exercising their inherent governmental authority and began to offer casino-style gaming. Some states were not happy, and so they went to federal court. And the result was the decision in 1987 from the United States Supreme Court, California versus Cabazon. The Cabazon decision unequivocally confirmed that tribes as sovereign governments have an inherent right to conduct gaming activities on tribal lands, state laws notwithstanding. The decision prompted Minnesota tribes to create MIGA to educate and advocate on behalf of Indian gaming this new economic tool. Not surprisingly, though, many state governments alarmed about wide open tribal gaming complained to Congress. So a year later, Congress passed an Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which is known as IGRA, and it restricted tribal sovereignty. IGRA tribes are now required to negotiate compacts with their states in order to conduct gambling. Our tribes in Minnesota reacted very quickly to the new federal law. And once they agreed not to offer popular casino games such as roulette, craps, and keno, Governor Perpich agreed to sign the slot machine compacts with the 11 tribes. 2 years later, Governor Carlson signed blackjack compacts with the same 11 tribes. From that time forward, MIGA has protected the viability of tribal gaming by opposing expansion of commercial or state-sponsored casino games. The goal is to give tribes the ability to implement tribal gaming as an indispensable economic development tool. But inevitably, it didn't take long before commercial gaming interest groups began to pressure the legislature to authorize casino gaming as part of their business. Thus, we saw the campaigns to put slot machines in bars, at racetracks, and at proposed casinos at the Mall of America and in downtown Minneapolis. These expansion efforts failed. They were opposed not just by tribes, but by charitable gaming groups, religious groups, and those concerned about problem gaming. However, you should know that the tribes have made certain accommodations over the years to the state. In 2001, the MIGA tribes did not oppose the efforts by the racetracks to set up card clubs and legalize poker. And during the 2012 session of the legislature, the tribes made two decisions at Governor Dayton's urging. First, the Shakopee Midwakanton Sioux tribe agreed to subsidize Canterbury Park racing purses and permit tracks to offer blackjack games. In return, Canterbury withdrew its support for slots at the track. Both sides have honored this agreement for the past 9 years. Second, at Governor Dayton's request, the tribes withdrew their opposition to electronic pull tabs, which was the potential funding source for the Viking Stadium. In return, the legislature explicitly required that electronic pull tab games must not mimic slot machines and may only be electronic facsimiles of paper pull tabs. Unfortunately, over the last several years, gaming technology has advanced very rapidly, and regulators have approved electronic games that we believe include features that mimic slot machines. We believe these new games go beyond the intent and the language of the 2012 legislation, and MIGA is now considering how to address this, along with other off-reservation gaming issues. Casinos are a tribal government's most vital revenue. I think President Buck made that point very, very clearly. The slot machines, however, are the only games that the state still restricts and confines to tribal casinos. These machines, in essence, provide the tax base for tribal governments to fund education, clinics, housing, and other essential services. But this revenue stream is very fragile. The state can unilaterally erode it at any time. Please remember, for the last 30 years, in spite of no direct state support, this activity has significantly benefited the state's economy while caring for the tribal members and providing jobs for thousands of Minnesotans. 85% of these jobs are held by non-tribal members living in surrounding communities located mainly in rural counties where good paying jobs with benefits are very scarce. All of this is why the MIGA tribes work continuously to keep tribal gaming a strong and effective economic tool for the governments, for their members, and for the neighboring communities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much for the invitation, members of the committee. We appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Kozak. And I'm going to make a slight deviation from our normal policy of holding everything until after the testifiers to recognize Representative Haley, who I should have recognized earlier, given her representation of the Prairie Island community. So Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair, very much. And I won't be long. I just wanted to show my support for the Prairie Island community and thank President Buck for her presentation. And I wanted to reemphasize some of the points that she made. I live in Red Wing. I was born and raised in Red Wing and proud to represent the community. I was young before the Prairie Island Indian community started their Treasure Island Casino. So I remember the days before, and the economic impact of their success and their growth has just been phenomenal. And as President Buck said, they employ 1,700 people. They are the largest employer in our town and in our county. So their success is our success. We have a very mutually beneficial relationship. And in addition to that, it's not just the casino operations, but the golf course, the marina, the concert venue, all of those attract tourism and thus money to our community. And there would be nothing else that would replace that if they their financial success was impacted. So I just wanted to go on record offering my support and maybe broadening that perspective for the committee members. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me a few minutes.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Our next testifier is Mr. Adam Prock from the Minnesota Lottery. Mr. Prock.
Thank you. Thank you. Just one second here. I think we're going to share a screen with a presentation. Assuming the technology works. I apologize for the delay here. There we go. Hopefully everyone's able to see that.
I think we see it.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adam Prock, and I have the honor of serving as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Lottery. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Our mission is to raise money for programs that positively impact the lives of Minnesotans. We do this by offering fun, secure entertainment for our players. Minnesotans have enjoyed our product for more than 30 years. Since the passage of the constitutional amendment that created the Minnesota Lottery, more than $3 billion has been returned to the state of Minnesota. The majority of that money has gone to the General Fund and the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, with the remainder split between the Game and Fish and Natural Resources Funds and programs dedicated to the treatment and prevention of problem gambling. In Minnesota, we provide two types of games, traditional scratch-off games and lotto draw games, such as Go for Five and popular multi-state games like Powerball and Mega Millions, which you've probably seen something about in the media recently. The lottery employs 156 employees. The majority work out of our Roseville headquarters, but we also maintain regional offices in Detroit Lakes, Marshall, Owatonna, and Virginia. Currently, we sell our product via our partnership with about 3,000 retailers across Minnesota. Our retail partnerships are the backbone of our success. Additionally, by partnering with organizations, institutions, and high-profile events, the lottery supports a variety of important initiatives and demonstrates a commitment to Minnesota communities. While participating in events has been limited by COVID-19 in 2020 and continues as we head into 2021, partnerships remain an important way for us to reach players and deliver on our mission. We continue to find appropriate ways to engage today in today's virtual and more socially distant world. When someone spends a dollar on a lottery ticket, most of it goes back to winners in the form of prizes. A small percentage is put towards things like administrative costs and vendors. Almost 7% is dedicated to our retailers, and the remainder goes back to the state. While statute allows the lottery to spend up to 9% of revenue on operations costs, we currently dedicate only 4.2% to those expenses. Keeping our costs down where possible allows us to capitalize on efficiencies and give more back to Minnesotans. At the lottery, we take our part in service to Minnesota very seriously. And over the past decade, the lottery has seen steady increases in sales. This trend has led to three consecutive years of record sales. Record sales mean bigger returns to the state, supporting the general fund, invigorating environmental programs, and funding important work to encourage responsible gaming and treat gambling disorders. Fiscal year 2020 also set a record for dollars returned to the state, prizes to be paid to players, and commissions paid out to our retail partners across the state. Like many states, Minnesota has seen an increase in lottery sales during the COVID-19 pandemic. Our lottery games provide fun, inexpensive entertainment that players can purchase while they're out running errands and play from the comfort of their homes. Fiscal year 2021 is on pace to set another record year. Compared to this point on the calendar last year, our sales are up 21.5%. leading to even more returns to the state. Put another way, we are at about 58% of the way through the fiscal year and have already achieved 70% of our sales goals. Strong sales in recent years is a validation of our commitment to selling fewer tickets to a broader base of players rather than more tickets to a narrower group of players. Like all Minnesotans, we've had to adjust to how we conduct business during the COVID-19 pandemic. We suspended most of our marketing from March to September and continue to monitor the situation to ensure our marketing practices are appropriate during these challenging times. Our 150-plus employees largely transitioned to working remotely while continuing to provide quality service and a top-rate product. Where remote work was not possible, changes were made to protect employees. Team member safety has always been a priority for the lottery. Working with our retailers and our partner associations, we also took steps to address retailer safety concerns. This included maintaining quality communications with all of our partners. Annually, we hold retail town halls with small businesses that play a key role in our success. This year, we held our town halls virtually. Instead of traveling the states we did this to ensure our retail partners still had the important opportunity to engage with us. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee today and for the support the legislature has shown the lottery over the years. It is really appreciated. In summary, things are going very well at the lottery. We're on pace for our fourth year in a row of record sales. And we're proud of the more than $3 billion that we've given back to the state. You'll find we are reaching out to each of you on this committee to ensure that you have all the information you need from us. Please don't hesitate to follow up with me or our legislative team if you have anything else that you'd like to further discuss. Mr. Chair, this concludes my formal presentations, but I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Prock. Our next testifier will be Al Lund of the Allied Charities. Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity today, committee members. My name is Alan Lund. I have been the executive director of Allied Charities of Minnesota since 2012. Allied Charities is a 501c6 trade association that represents all licensed gambling organizations in Minnesota, and currently there are roughly 1,126 of us. ACM advocates, lobbies, and educates in regards to charitable gambling in Minnesota. Charitable gambling goes back to Minnesota in the 1940s when bingo was the first form approved by the state. Primarily at that time, it was church basement bingo. Charitable organizations use proceeds from gambling to sustain a statewide safety net that is now over 75 years old. Each year, tens of millions of dollars are raised to help those in need, to fund local programs in nearly every community in the state, and to support organizations' non-profit missions. Charitable gambling proceeds support veterans, youth sports, food shelves, veterans, elder assistance, the arts, school programs, civic celebrations, and hundreds of other essential fundraising causes. Charitable gambling has become a vital and essential fundraising tool for many nonprofit organizations in every corner of Minnesota. I was the gambling manager at the St. Michael American Legion from 2009 to 2012. Our previous gambling manager became ill, and I was asked to fill in until he could return, which he was never able to do. When I took over, our organization was losing money. We were members of Allied Charities, and I asked the then executive director of ACM to help me figure out what was wrong with our operation. I know that it is hard to believe that an organization conducting gambling can actually lose money, but in fiscal year 2020, we had 37 organizations that lost money. In fiscal year 2017, for the first time as a group, licensed gambling charities paid more in taxes and fees than they had for their local communities and nonprofit missions. 3 years later, in fiscal year 2020, we had 344 organizations pay more in taxes and fees than they had for their communities and missions. In fiscal year 2020, we paid $84 million in taxes and fees and made donations totaling $65 million. In fiscal year 2020, the average charity paid 27% of their net receipts, which is sales minus prizes, in taxes and fees. We are allowed no deductions of any kind. We pay the gambling tax on every dollar banked. In fiscal year 2020, for every dollar in sales, 84.9 cents went back in prizes, leaving us with 15.1 cents for paying our expenses, taxes, and fees. What was left over goes to donations. We averaged 8 cents for expenses and 4.1 cents for taxes and fees, leaving us with 3 cents per dollar wagered for donations, sometimes less than that. While tax relief would be welcome, ACM have a policy issue that we hope to bring to your committee this year. Allied Charities has been hearing from numerous member organizations that would like to offer multiple electronic bingo or pull tab systems in their sites, but have been told by the bar, distributor, manufacturer that it is not an option. Let me be clear, we are not asking to increase the number of devices per site. We are only asking for legislation that would give the charity the option of mixing the brands of electronic devices at a site. Until a few years ago, the manufacturers were required by statute to sell their products to all distributors in the state. This sell to all law was designed to foster competition. The only exception was for certain games, usually paper pull tab games, sold on an exclusive basis to a single distributor. But after electronic bingo and pull tabs were permitted, the statute was changed to create another exception for electronic systems and software. This change gave an electronic manufacturer the ability to choose who they will and will not sell to. It allows a manufacturer to sell to only one distributor. It also allows a manufacturer to refuse to sell to a distributor, including if a distributor attempts to sell a competing electronic product. The argument for exempting electronic systems and software from the sell to all law was that proprietary information might be passed from distributors to competing manufacturers. In the past 8.5 years that electronics have been available, I am not aware of any case where proprietary information was stolen or misused by a distributor or licensed organization. We have always said that the consumer will be the ultimate decision maker of who wins or loses in the charitable gambling market. That means that multiple providers need to have unhindered access to our customers. Today, that is not happening. ACM will be supporting legislation that would require electronic manufacturers to sell to any licensed organization, regardless of the presence of a competing system in a site or not. ACM believes that the decision of what to carry across all of the legal forms of charitable gambling is a decision best left up to the charity and not anyone else. We thank you for your time today. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have at the end of the presentation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Our next testifier is Mr. Stephen May of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve May. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. I was appointed last year in April, so this is my first time to present for you today, and I will share a screen. Okay, do you see the presentation? Okay. The Minnesota Racing Commission regulates horse racing and cargo operations in Minnesota. What I'd like to do is just go through a brief history of the major milestones in legislation for parimutuel wagering in Minnesota. In 1982, there was a constitutional amendment that allowed legal parimutuel wagering on horse racing, and the regulatory structure was set up in 1983. The next major milestone would be 1999, where legislation was passed to authorize card room operations at both parimutuel racetracks in Minnesota. And in 2016, there was legislation that enabled account wagering operations where patrons could place wagers on their phone or computer remotely. Today, we have two parimutuel racetracks in Minnesota. We have Canterbury Park in Scott County, opened in 1985. Mm-hmm. And we have Running Aces Casino Hotel and Racetrack, which opened in 2008. It's in Columbus, Minnesota, which, of course, is represented in the Bars District. A brief overview of how the Racing Commission operates. We have a 9-member independent commission that serves 6-year terms. We have approximately 14 full-time year-round employees that operate for live racing and card room operations. And then during the summer, we employ about 40 to 50 seasonal and contract employees to help with live racing. The general overview, jurisdiction of the commission is that we do oversee the conduct of live thoroughbred, quarter horse, and standardbred racing at the two parimutuel racetracks. We oversee simulcast wagering on global races at both parimutuel racetracks year-round. We oversee the account wagering operations on non-Minnesota races for which Minnesota residents are wagering. And we do oversee the card club operations at both the parimutuel racetracks. To do this, we collect taxes on wagering operations as well as regulatory fees on racing and wagering operations. We operate a breeders fund, which offers incentives for horse owners and breeders to operate in Minnesota, which creates a huge economic impact on the state. And we also distribute grants for racehorse retirement programs to take care of our equine athletes after the racing time is done. Specific to the card room operations, we do license all card club employees as well as the manufacturers and the vendors that are involved in the card casino operations. We work with independent third-party testing providers to do compliance testing on gaming products, and then we also do independent field testing of those products once they are operational in Minnesota. We work very closely with the security and surveillance teams at both of the parimutuel racetracks to oversee the gaming operations and have a very good working relationship with them. And we also conduct investigations in the card club operations as well as on the racing side as needed. The next slide is just a brief overview of the various occupational licenses that were issued in 2019. Obviously, didn't choose 2020 because of the significant impacts of COVID-19. This is a broad overview of how the licenses that we issued in 2019. The Racing Commission receives no general fund appropriation for our operations. Instead, we have licensing fees on the racetracks as well as the racing participants. We also have regulatory fees that are charged to online wagering operators from our account wagering operations. And then we also have the authority to seek reimbursements from the racetracks cover commission costs. Fine monies, on the other hand, does not go into our budget. Those fine monies are all restricted to retired racehorse programs as well as research. So very good operation in Minnesota. In 2016, there was an economic impact study that was sponsored by the Met Racing Commission. It did show about a $409 million economic impact to the state, and the breakdown of those are provided on this slide as well. And it did show approximately 5,590 full and part-time jobs. We're prepared to do another economic impact study, but we're working with the University of Minnesota Extension at Mankato. Decided to wait on this until things hopefully stabilize in the next few years after the COVID-19 pandemic has subsided. The strength of the racing industry in Minnesota, that we do have very strong fan participation, especially at least in non-COVID-19 years. The racetracks were very resilient and altered their operations in 2020 to do the best they could, but it obviously had a pretty big impact on the operations at the racetrack. We have a very good working relationship with the horsemen in the industry as well in Minnesota, both on the standardbred side as well as the thoroughbred and quarter horse side. And as previously mentioned, Canterbury Park has a strong marketing agreement with the Shakopee, Midwaukee, and Sioux community that provides purse enhancements as well as marketing opportunities for the racing and gaming. Some of the threats that we do have is, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic has significantly impacted the live participation at the racetrack for fans as well as horsemen. Other states also offer alternative gaming options, which subsidize purses and has caused a lot of owners and trainers to seek racing elsewhere. And something that you may have been contacted from some of your constituents, Minnesota residents are not able to wager on Minnesota races online, and so that does provide a threat to the industry. There was some federal legislation that was signed into law in December of 2020. It does have a start date of July 1st of 2022. This is called the Horse Racing Safety and Integrity Act. It's going to create a new federal agency that's going to oversee a large portion of racing operations, especially in drug testing for post-race testing, as well as racetrack safety programs. We are working very closely with some of the authors of this bill and some of the key industry players to stay ahead of this and to understand how it's going to affect Minnesota. That's all I have right now. My contact information is on this slide, and I'll be happy to address any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. And then our last testifier is Matt Getman of the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. Mr. Getman.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and honorable presenters. My name is Matt Getman. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Agency, the Gambling Control Board. Gaming on sovereign land, the lottery, the racing commission, are all separate legal gambling operations in Minnesota. Under this board's purview, Minnesota ranks number one in the U.S. for lawful, or also known as charitable gambling, reaching over $2 billion in gross sales for each of the last 3 years. My predecessor used to joke it's a multi-billion dollar industry, exclusively using cash, run mainly by volunteers at alcoholic establishments. What could possibly go wrong? Well, the Gambling Control Board regulates charitable gambling to ensure the integrity of the operations and the lawful use of the net profits. Lawful gambling in Minnesota includes five forms of gambling: bingo, pull tabs, and both bingo and pull tabs are also available electronically on closed systems using iPads, and there are also raffles and tip boards. Which includes sports-themed tip boards, so some would say that Minnesota. And finally, a fifth type of gambling is paddle wheels that is conducted in two forms. The less common is a paddle wheel with table, and the more prevalent is a paddle wheel that is commonly used to conduct. Net profits from these five types of gambling are used by Minnesota veterans and their families, fraternal groups, including Eagles, Moose, Elks, and Knights of Columbus, clubs, including the Lions, JCs, Rods and Guns, sports and snowmobile clubs, youth activities, fire safety equipment for local communities, religious and community educational and training programs, support for local units of government and community projects, and finally, wildlife and natural resource programs. The Gambling Control Board is entirely funded by the industry it regulates. All fees collected go into the dedicated lawful gambling regulatory account. License fees are collected from manufacturers, distributors, distributor salespeople, and linked bingo game providers. Manufacturers also pay for game approvals and testing. Nonprofit organizations conducting gambling pay licenses and premises permit fees, along with a regulatory fee based on gross sales. The board itself consists of seven volunteer citizens appointed to the board and 32 state employees staff. Those 32 staff provide regulatory oversight, education, and guidance throughout the charitable gambling industry and are broken into three departments within the board: the licensing, auditing, and investigations, and are spread out over four offices throughout the four corners of the state: Hibbing, Mankato, Fergus Falls, and the main offices in Roseville. Please let me recognize some highlights in 2020. The COVID pause led the board to unilaterally drive towards and ultimately obtain executive orders to help charitable organizations through that tumultuous time. One was to keep the veterans and fraternal organizations' doors open by authorizing a reverse loan of the gambling proceeds back to the parent organization that maintained those organizations' buildings. Second was a star rating requirement that waived those requirements for fiscal year 20. Third was gambling equipment credit sales exemptions. Fourth, a license renewal date extension. And finally, emergency gambling manager training requirements were extended as well. In line with the gambling manager or GM training requirement extensions, the board set up a brand new multi-day GM seminar online. The board also increased options for continuing education for those incumbent gambling managers. The board ensured regulatory compliance during record monthly sales that occurred between the COVID pauses. July through October averaged $250 million in gross sales each month, even though there were limited site locations that each had COVID-related capacity restrictions. But the board's customer service did not pause. We migrated to cell phones for staff, telecommuting, online service for the industry, and revamped site inspections, and also held the public board meetings virtually. The board also maintained a perfect on-time record of reporting and oversight requirements. However, this last year did not come without issues. The industry continued to be an all-cash industry, which comes with its own problems. The charity's tax structure and other expenses were more controversial, especially for those larger organizations where available funds for charitable purposes have declined, while their taxes and other expenses rose. And the industry also saw a movement towards consolidation of gambling equipment providers. And on the regulatory side, the board grapples with the need for upgrading the board's IT resources and the ability to backfill two of its open seven citizen appointments. And finally, staffing levels that remained unchanged despite the huge growth of the industry and its complexity. We look forward to discussing proposals to address these issues and others during this upcoming legislative session and work with each of you to answer any questions about our proposals and or the industry itself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for this opportunity to introduce the board to your committee and stand by for any questions. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Getman. We now have some time for member questions. I do have one question that I was hoping to ask Mr. Prock at the lottery. Mr. Prock, I wanted to ask you about reauthorizing the portion of the lottery revenue that goes into the Environmental Natural Resource Trust Fund. I wonder if you could comment on that reauthorization.
Well, I know that that authorization, I believe, happens in 2025. The lottery doesn't have a position on it. That obviously is something that the legislature will have to address. We're happy to raise the money, and obviously we look to you for guidance as to where that goes.
Well, I certainly value the investments that have been able to be made with those funds into our state's most precious resources, our lakes and woods. So I certainly hope that we're able to reauthorize that. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment that I personally have been on LCCMR, which is spending the lottery money for a couple of years, and it's been very interesting going through all the projects that come for proposal, the guidelines that we have to adhere to, but also we do some tours, and it's just great to see what's happening in Minnesota. So I am very honored to be on that committee and to spend some of Minnesota's money, gambling money. With that as well, I also like to participate in a lot of the meat raffles that happen at our local bars. I do think we need to do some work in making sure that more of that money goes to the charities. Right now, we have a wonderful young man who is advocating for the St. Cloud State kids activities. And he is just a joy to see, but also his mission and his dedication to the children is amazing. We need to make sure that we do a better job of making sure more of those monies go into their pockets. And that is always my concern. So, thank you very much for the presentation. Always very interesting. And have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Always good to see some bipartisan support for the good work that we're able to do with the lottery funds in the environment and natural resource space. Representative Lisligard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and what a wonderful presentation and a lot of information shared that was very helpful. I do feel for each organization because I know what you guys contribute to our local communities and the charities, and I've watched the VFWs, I've watched the American Legions really struggle. And in small communities, that is where people engage. They go to burger night and they spend quality time with each other. And we were shut down and it did impact them. I think I know the answer, but I wanted to ask Mr. Brock. It seemed like everyone else in this gambling system has suffered except you. And I would like to know, do you believe that that is because nowhere else was to participate in gambling is why you've done so well and everyone else has suffered? I wanted your thoughts on that.
Mr. Prock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we believe that the COVID-19 pandemic certainly has had some effect on an increase in sales. We have a fun, entertaining product that people can play from home. So during the original stay-at-home order, certainly that was an effect on sales. But we also have had award-winning marketing campaigns, as well as our belief that we've had an effort to try and sell fewer tickets to a broader base of people. We think all of those things have combined to create an increase in sales over this time. But certainly the fact that we have a fun, entertaining product that can be played from home has certainly helped with sales, yes.
And I represent Lissegard.
No, just thank you so much for everyone for the presentation and to the, to everyone that gives to the charities. Thank you so much because I know what it means to small communities. So thank you.
Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. My question is also for Mr. Prock or maybe Ms. Pampu. And I am curious about the potential of winning the lottery and remaining anonymous. I know that a handful of states in the union allow people to do that. And I'm not familiar myself with the background in Minnesota and if there has been any movement or discussion in order to kind of move forward with that. It looks like, as I'm understanding it, if you buy a ticket in a state that allows you to remain anonymous, then you can do so. So perhaps some of our neighbors over in Moorhead or the west side of the state are able to just pop right over the border and buy their ticket in North Dakota. But for the rest of us, I'm curious what that might look like. And I think that especially when you're looking at the big numbers like have been over the past few weeks, certainly there's some potential for people to kind of remain under the radar if that were the case. So I'm curious on your thoughts on that.
Mr. Prock.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This has certainly been an issue. It is something I actually testified on the Senate side this morning on, in fact, a bill there. There are a number of states, I believe it's 9 now, that do allow you to remain anonymous as a winner. Minnesota is not one of those states. The majority of states, however, believe that transparency is key to the lottery for people having trust in the lottery. And so we try to maintain that trust in people. And so we do not allow anonymity here. What we say to people is you've got 100 days to cash your ticket, or you got a year to cash your ticket. Take your time, settle in, get your things in order, and then come in. That typically helps as well. Some of the states that do allow anonymity do it in different ways. There are states that have allowed for some sort of cap. So perhaps if you win more than $1 million, you can remain anonymous. Other states have allowed you to do it in trust. There are states that have set a window that said maybe if you go 3 months, you can remain anonymous. Again, you don't have to cash your ticket for up to a year. Here at the lottery, we try to balance that thing. I want to be very clear, the safety and security of our players is key to us. We take that very seriously. So if you do win, we do everything we can to make sure that we maintain that. But we also have to balance that with the integrity of the lottery, because we are a state agency that is potentially giving out hundreds of millions of dollars, and making sure that we balance that trust so people know that that's going to real Minnesotans are winning. It's not lottery employees that are winning. They're real Minnesotans, and they're winning throughout all of the state. And so finding that balance has been important to us as we've tried to tackle this issue.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you. No follow-up.
Thank you. And I don't see, I'm just going to check my little notepad here, but I don't see any other people seeking recognition to ask a question. So I will thank all of our testifiers today. This was, I thought, a very great hearing, lots of great information. And I'll thank members of the committee, and we can call the day a little early today. We start taking up bills tomorrow. And so with that, I will adjourn the hearing.